Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the big guy, Mr. 10%, that would be President Biden, addressed the nation yesterday morning after all that transpired over the weekend that we discussed at some length yesterday with respect to the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and the closure of Signature Bank of New York on Sunday evening, the announcement by the Fed / Treasury that the federal government is moving to back all bank deposits. And what did we get from President Biden? A lot of the sort of the same sort of rhetoric we've become familiar with. Somebody who has a very simplistic understanding, to the extent he has any understanding at all or any interest in understanding, of the policy and the policy discussion in a particular sector, such as banking, is complicated. So what's the top line that we were supposed to take away from yesterday?
That this is the Republicans' fault.
That's one of them, right? Looking for scapegoats.
Yes. And that
right?
Everything's fine, that our deposits are safe. That's what I learned yesterday.
Correct. And mm-hmm. no yeah. taxpayer funding.
Right. Yeah.
You know, this is not a bank bailout, except
no.
it is a bank. It is a federal government bank bailout. Now, here's the important thing. The important thing is how important this was. You know how we know this was important to Mr. 10%? This is a big issue.
Because he got up before 8 o'clock or something?
Jen Psaki, his former White House spokesman.
Now, it's important to note, President Biden does nothing at 9 a.m. He is a night owl. So the fact that he is doing this at 9 a.m. anyway speaks to how vital the White House recognizes it is for him to have his voice out there conveying that to the American public.
All right, Steve Rettner, thank
right.
you very
much. Yeah, that's bizarre. Thank you, though. That's so that really, I want you to understand how committed he is, how important this is to him. He got up before 9 a.m. That's interesting. There's a 2021 article that was posted on CNN, uh-huh. just as a quick aside before we get to the substance of it, just to show you how pathological is the prevarication of people like Jen Psaki. Inside the new president's routine, Oval Office fires and early bedtimes. Unlike his most recent predecessors, night owls who spent the dark hours reading briefing materials, Biden is more of an early to bed type.
Oh, really? So which one is it?
He's an early to bed. He's a late to rise. He just doesn't do much of anything except they wind him up from time to time to go out and do the best he can to read off the teleprompter, to make assurances that are really beyond his capacity to make and are nothing that anyone can bank on, pun intended. So back to what he actually said yesterday. Here was Joe Biden's promises to the American people about the banking system, what he's doing about it.
And here are the highlights. First, all customers who had deposits in these banks can rest assured. I want to rest assured they'll be protected and they'll have access to their money as of today. That includes small businesses across the country that bank there and need to make payroll, pay their bills, and stay open for business. No losses will be, and I want, this is an important point, no losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Let me repeat that. No losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Instead, the money will come from the fees that banks pay into the deposit insurance fund. Because of the actions of that because of the actions that our regulators have already taken, every American should feel confident that their deposits will be there if and when they need them. Second, the management of these banks will be fired. If the bank is taken over by FDIC, the people running the bank should not work there anymore. Third, investors in the banks will not be protected. They knowingly took a risk, and when the risk didn't pay off, investors lose their money. That's how capitalism works. And fourth, there are important questions of how these banks got into the circumstance in the first place. We must get the full accounting of what happened and why those responsible can be held accountable. In my administration, no one is above the law. And finally, we must reduce the risk of this happening again. During the Obama-Biden administration, we put in place tough requirements on banks like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, including the Dodd-Frank law to make sure that the crisis we saw in 2008 would not happen again. Unfortunately, the last administration rolled back some of these requirements. I'm going to ask Congress and the banking regulators to strengthen the rules for banks to make it less likely this kind of bank failure would happen again, and to protect American jobs and small businesses. Look, the bottom line is this. Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
Are you resting assured? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Well, regional banks were routed on Wall Street yesterday, in part because there's more regulation that is believed to be coming, and you've sort of heard the big guy indicate that. And, you know, what's the need to take any risk with a arm's length relationship with your local bank when Silicon Valley is too big to fail? When the federal government's going to step in and back all of these plays, including uninsured depositors.
And those managers that he's talking about, you know, who failed need to get fired. Well, they all paid out bonuses to everybody just before the FDIC seized the property, seized the bank.
The question is, who is being bailed out here? This is bailing out small businesses and you know, Johnny Punch Clock and Sally Housecoat. Charles Payne over at Fox Business offered this rant yesterday morning after POTUS got done speaking. This is outstanding. Charles Payne answers my question.
First and foremost, for me, this was a bailout of Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley Bank, of Silicon Valley. And everyone needs to be clear on that. This was not a bailout of hardworking Americans and small accounts. This was a bank that only catered, for the most part, to Silicon Valley and their customers. So how does Silicon Valley get so big? All of the money that cascaded into our economy at the beginning of the pandemic helped to spur that big IPO and SPAC streak, if you guys remember. We had over 1,000 IPOs, 59% of offerings, 59% of SPACs. 90% of them were pure crap. The others all went out overvalued. Everyone who bought them at the IPO price, every American is losing money right now, even before this crisis. In the meantime, though, all of that money went to Silicon Valley Bank. Their deposits went up 300% to $200 billion. The average bank over that same time frame, their deposits went up 35%. So they're living large, they're having a great time. What do they do with the money? They don't lend it out. They don't lend it out. By the way, who the hell needs a loan in Silicon Valley? They don't lend it out. So they put it into different things, and they start loan, and, you know, start investing with it. Then things look a little dicey, so they say, okay, well, let's buy these bonds. Now, this is a real tricky part. This is why I think the overall market's getting hammered a little bit this morning. When banks put these bonds, there's two ways you can put bonds on your books. One is held to maturity. If you do that, you don't have to mark the ups and downs of the bond market. Right. You don't have to mark that on the on your balance sheet. The ones that are for sale, you do, and you have to actively manage those. But the bulk of these bonds that they had were held to maturity. So the fact of the matter is the bond market took one of the worst drubbings it's ever had in the last year. The value of their, you know, the value of their bonds, their core asset, started to go down. Other things that happened, commercial back, mortgage-backed securities, they own a bunch of those. Those are getting decimated in part from work from home. Mm-hmm. But this is an irresponsible, reckless bank. But it's, and let's be clear. The American public must know. Every account in this country is insured to $250,000. Every single account. This was not about bailing out small accounts, regular Americans. The mean bank account in this country is $41,000. You want to go by, so if you look at, for instance, the average bank account for someone without a high school diploma, $9,000. Bachelor's degree, $79,000. This is another bailout of the elites. This is a bailout of Silicon Valley, the same Silicon Valley that just brought a Sam Bankman-Fried. The Silicon Valley that for 20 years grew companies privately to exorbitant valuations, outrageous valuations, and then foisted them on the public at even higher valuations. Mm-hmm. They have made so much money. I mean, only the Saudi Arabian princes can deal with the amount of money that they've made.
Silicon Valley bailout, not Silicon Valley Bank. Think bigger.
He's right.
By Wall Street Journal opining on whether this is a bailout, second bailout of the banking system in 15 years, it is. They write, this is a de facto bailout of the banking system, even as regulators and Biden officials have been telling us the economy is great and there's nothing to worry about. The unpleasant truth, which Washington will never admit, is that Silicon Valley Bank's failure is the bill coming due for years of monetary and regulatory mistakes, in addition to sort of the high-flying and negligent management of Silicon Valley Bank specifically. Also, with respect to what the big guy said about trying to put this on the Trump administration, he's referring to the modification of Dodd-Frank that raised the systemically important designation from $50 billion to $250 billion in assets, the systemically important financial institution, the sci-fi classification. Well, not even Barney Frank believes that's to blame. And by the way, Barney Frank, the author of Dodd-Frank, Guess on whose board he sat.
Oh, Silicon Valley?
Signature Bank of New York. He's a director on the board of the Signature Bank of New York, one of the first banks to fail in this latest round of regulatory and monetary, mistaken regulatory and monetary policy. The experts. The politicians. Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You know, George Bush once said after the 2008 crash that he had to abandon his free market principles to save the free market system. And sadly, that's become the norm today, this idea from politicians and others that we need to embrace socialism to save capitalism. And we all know when you embrace socialism, all you get is more socialism. And it's translated even to these woke CEOs in Silicon Valley. I saw one on CNN yesterday. Another one of these bearded guys with a beta male voice. And he was talking about, oh, I'm glad the government stepped in. And I expect the government to step in and save these people, as if he's got this entitlement mindset. And one thing I've always loved about capitalism is sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And when you lose, that gives you an opportunity to self-reflect and see where you went wrong. These people who will get bailed out, they'll never have the opportunity to do that because they won't have to.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about Biden's remarks yesterday and the federal bailout of the banking system that is afoot. I mentioned Barney Frank. I mean, this is just, it's one of those moments where there's a bit of a comeuppance for a officious politician. And so, you know, just to enjoy the little things like this. Barney Frank talking to Bloomberg about his bank. He's a director, was director, Signature Bank of New York. I think if we had been allowed to open tomorrow, he said on Sunday, we could have continued. We have a solid loan book. We're the biggest lender in New York City under the low-income housing tax credit. Hey, good for you. Wall Street Journal opining, it may be that regulators decided to roll up Signature Bank of New York because of its crypto association. It wouldn't be the first time regulators saw an opening in a crisis to achieve a political goal by other means. Barney Frank now knows how hundreds of thousands of other people in business feel when regulators panic for political reasons and look for businesses to shut or blame. Mr. Frank is getting a painful education in the difficulty of running a company when politicians don't like the business you're in. Welcome to the rent-seeking party, Barney. By the way, just to repeat, Biden's assertion that a modest rollback of a provision by the Trump administration that had increased the designation of systemically important financial institutions. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't think there was any laxity on the part of regulators in regulating the banks in that category from $50 billion to $250 billion. So it didn't have any effect, according to Barney Frank, even as, again, Biden and that squaw from Massachusetts are looking for angles in to blame Republicans. And then you have these pencil neck pea hats like Adam Schiff. Well, you know, Republicans answer to their wealthy donors, so hopefully there'll be some bipartisan measures that are advanced to shore up the banking system. Right.
Go run for U.S. Senate of California.
I mean, this is how you know somebody is incapable of honesty, as if there are not wealthy donors on both sides, first and foremost, number one. And number two, as if his party didn't just move to bail out Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley Bank, the distinction Charles Payne made yesterday, but Silicon Valley. Just Charles Payne again, because it's just so damn good.
First and foremost, for me, this was a bailout of Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley Bank, of Silicon Valley. And everyone needs to be clear on that. This was not a bailout of hardworking Americans and small accounts. This was a bank that only catered, for the most part, to Silicon Valley and their customers. So how does Silicon Valley get so big? All of the money that cascaded into our economy at the beginning of the pandemic helped to spur that big IPO and SPAC streak, if you guys remember. We had over 1,000 IPOs, 59% of offerings, 59% were SPACs. 90% of them were pure crap. The others all went out overvalued. Everyone who bought them at the IPO price, every American is losing money right now, even before this crisis. In the meantime, though, all of that money went to Silicon Valley Bank. Their deposits went up 300% to $200 billion. The average bank over that same time frame, their deposits went up 35%. So they're living large, they're having a great time. What do they do with the money? They don't lend it out. They don't lend it out. By the way, who the hell needs a loan in Silicon Valley? They don't lend it out. So they put it into different things, and they start loan, and you know, start investing with it. Then things look a little dicey, so they say, okay, well, let's buy these bonds. Now, this is a real tricky part. This is why I think the overall market's getting hammered a little bit this morning. When banks put these bonds, there's two ways you can put bonds on your books. One is held to maturity. If you do that, you don't have to mark the ups and downs of the bond market. Right. You don't have to mark that on the on your balance sheet. The ones that are for sale, you do, and you have to actively manage those. But the bulk of these bonds that they had were held to maturity. So the fact of the matter is the bond market took one of the worst drubbings it's ever had in the last year. The value of their bonds, their core asset, started to go down. Other things that happened, mortgage-backed securities, they own a bunch of those. Those are getting decimated in part from work from home. Mm-hmm. But this is an irresponsible, reckless bank. But it's let's be clear. The American public must know. Every account in this country is insured to $250,000. Every single account. This was not about bailing out small accounts, regular Americans. The mean bank account in this country is $41,000. You want to go by so if you look at, for instance, the average bank account for someone without a high school diploma, $9,000. Bachelor's degree, $79,000. This is another bailout of the elites. This is a bailout of Silicon Valley, the same Silicon Valley that just brought a Sam Bankman-Fried. The Silicon Valley that for 20 years grew companies privately to exorbitant valuations, outrageous valuations, and then foisted them on the public at even higher valuations. Mm-hmm. They have made so much money. I mean, only the Saudi Arabian princes can deal with the amount of money that they've made.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It is important to note with respect to these deposits and the federal government backstop of all depositors, not investors, but deposits, bank clients at Silicon Valley at Signature. The Wall Street Journal, again, typically in a bank failure, those depositors would get their money back with a 15 to 20% haircut, those with deposits above the $250,000. This would no doubt be a hardship for many customers, but the $250,000 limit was known. Will a universal uninsured deposit guarantee be next? That would be a monumental policy surrender, essentially admitting that the regulatory machinery established in 2010 by Dodd-Frank failed. We may be the only people in the world who still worry about moral hazard, but a nationwide guarantee for uninsured deposits, even for a limited time, means this will become the default policy anytime there's a financial panic. Well, that's it. That's what the left promises, a world without consequences. And so everybody gets comfortable with this idea that I make a mistake, somebody else picks up the tab.
Right. You don't have to be responsible. I loved Bernie Marcus. He's the Home Depot founder. His reaction to what happened yesterday.
I think that the administration has pushed many of these banks into more concern about global warming than they do about shareholder return. And these banks are badly run because everybody is focused on diversity and all of the woke issues and not concentrating on one thing they should, which is shareholder returns. Instead of protecting the shareholders and their employees, they're more concerned about the social policies. And I think it's probably a badly run bank. They've been there for a lot of years. It's pathetic that so many people lost money that won't get it back.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. ESG and DIE. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. And in fact, so these memes going around, we mentioned yesterday that Forbes had Silicon Valley Bank as one of the financial superstars of 2022, one of the best banks in the country of 2022. That was 90 days ago. Also, there was a screenshot in Times Square of the DIE officer, diversity, inclusion, equity officer for Silicon Valley Bank, featured on some advertisement or getting some recognition on one of the video jumbotrons in Times Square. That's what's important. Not minding the store. Yep. Playing politics is what's important. Well, where do they learn that? D.C. again, rent seeking. Hey, if it's good enough for all the kids with their student loans, how about for us venture capitalists? We know all these guys.
Yeah.
We finance their campaigns. Hey, you know, how about a little help over here? And they got it. Brian in St. John, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. That was an interesting segue. I don't pretend to know the banking industry, but I was going to ask you, what's the hiring process with these banks? Do they hire the best candidates, or do they hire in the name of equity? And I think you just answered it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Well, yeah, and then Signature Bank in New York, Barney Frank is a director. I rest my case.
You don't have to say anything else.
George in Naperville.
Man, I think you're wrong about Biden. I heard he's a real night owl. He's been seen at all the D.C. nightclubs, tripping the light fantastic.
Yeah, emphasis on tripping. Very good. All right, George. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Well, in a former life, I was a banker, and my husband is still a banker, so I know a lot about banking.
Oh.
But yeah, I do. I did it for 15 years. I was a commercial lender, you know, asset-based lending used to be a big thing in Chicago. It was a huge thing. That's what we did. Anyway, the banking industry, perception is reality as far as the banking industry being on shaky ground. So, of course, you're going to see, quote-unquote, runs on the bank, people in line trying to withdraw their money. It's just like It's a Wonderful Life, you know. Perception is reality. So you think your money's going to be gone, you're going to go withdraw it, right?
Where are the George Baileys in the U.S. banking today, Mary Kay?
There aren't any.
Exactly.
Yeah, there aren't any. What a bunch of numbskulls, you know, Barney Frank being numero uno. What a joke. You know, you were right. Who's being bailed out in Silicon Valley? The kids, the techie kids who are, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're again, we have frauds, you know, but they're young and they're hip and they're cool with their beards and they're this and they're that. And they have everybody fooled, too. You know,
Charles Payne said it. Sam Bankman-Fried, the same folks that gave you Sam Bankman-Fried.
And exactly.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Hey, look, if we can pay for these the kids at the tech startups, you can pay for their Princeton education, then,
yeah,
you know, why not just keep paying?
Keep going.
Keep paying for their mistakes. Roger, Southside.
Hi. Everything you've talked about with this banking situation, in my opinion, this is what has created the middle class. I'll tell you why. The middle class works and pays. It pays up, pays down, and actually pays their bills, okay? Because we can't stand the stink from the top or the bottom. It's the small amount of freedom that we buy for ourselves and our families. Because, I mean, these people are pathetic at the top and at the bottom. I mean, you know, we're willing to work 100 hours a week to not have to be around these people, to not listen to them. You know, and they have figured out, the white elitists and the rich have figured it out. They know how much they sicken us. But you know what? Eventually, now they're pushing the limits of where we won't be a middle class. Well, what's left for us to do? Well, there's going to be an elimination process. And I'll tell you something. I know what side I want to be on.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The big guy, Mr. 10%, President Biden, in addition to addressing the banking crisis, he also recently sat down, I think this was after 9 a.m., though, with Cal Penn. Cal Penn. You know, Harold
and
Kumar.
That's his real name, Cal Penn.
Cal Penn, the actor from Harold and Kumar, who then went on to be a White House flunky in the Joe Obama's first two terms.
What?
Yeah.
He's back, okay. Yeah.
He's guest hosting The Daily Show as they wind down that franchise that Trevor Noah tanked. And sat down with the big guy, got a little Oval Office tour back to his old confines. And then they got down to business, talking serious policy, because that's what those two policy wonks do.
Oh, boy.
And interesting choice of Joe Biden. Chose to inveigh on the issue of trans and, of course, focus on the state of Florida and Ron DeSantis. This is what Joe Biden said about essentially the legislation that we talked about quite a bit that was purposely demagogued by the left. And when I say purposely demagogued, they purposely misunderstood and promoted a misunderstanding of the legislation for political reasons, of course, and it continues.
Transgender kids is a really harder thing. What's going on in Florida is, as my mother would say, close to sinful. I mean, it's just terrible what they're doing. It's not like, you know, a kid wakes up one morning and says, you know, I decided I want to become a man or I want to become a woman or I want to change. I mean, What are they thinking about here? They're human beings. They love. They have feelings. They have inclinations that are, I mean, it just to me is, I don't know, it's cruel. And the way we do it is we make sure we pass legislation like we passed on same-sex marriage. You mess with that, you're breaking the law, and you're going to be held accountable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some people are taking up this cause. You know, in the direction that the big guy suggests. Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota signed an executive order to essentially create a Minnesota as a, or designate Minnesota as a sanctuary state for mutilating children. This executive order in Minnesota, in response to moves in places like Florida to prohibit what the left calls gender-affirming care, what we know from science, has long-lasting negative consequences for kids. It's not nice, close to sinful. Puberty blockers, mutilation, letting kids drive the train when it comes to these sorts of life-altering decisions. And then it, also something that is terribly unkind, ignoring, as the leftists want to do, ignoring the consequences of their policy choices, ignoring all of those who are transitioning and detransitioned and have substantial regrets to the point of suicidal thoughts, like that young woman in Canada we brought you the other week, who wants the Canadian euthanasia squad to end her misery now because she cut off her breasts and nobody tried to, nobody told her to pump the brakes.
They told her to do it. Push their agenda. Let's go.
Talk through this. Right. Yeah. With modest consultation, which was all, as you say, cheerleading every step of the way.
God, I remember when I was old enough to remember you'd have to go through a year, a solid year of counseling multiple times a week if you wanted to have anything done to your body. If you're transitioning or thinking about it, that's how long they spent. And now it's what? Whatever they feel like?
Well, you know, you have dudes testifying before the Minnesota legislature in promotion of this. Like this guy.
I saw this.
Dressed up as a woman.
My name is Amber Mum. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a member of the St. Cloud Hive of the Parents and Allies of Trans Youth, the Transgender Movement for Liberation, and a member of the Tea Time Support Group run by the Aliveness Project. I am also a proud transgender woman, but more importantly, I am the mother of two wonderful transgender and gender expansive children. I drove down from St. Cloud to show my support for House File 146 and thank Representative Finke for introducing such an important and life-saving bill to protect trans children and their families at such a critical time for us.
The executive order the governor of Minnesota signed defers to the authority of major professional associations such as the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, WPATH, which last year recognized UNIC as a valid gender identity that children can possess. This is what you want for your kids? This is what's being nice to kids? This is what is avoiding sinfulness? To borrow from the big guy's mom, since he invoked her, like she always said. Bizarre. Just such a goof. Okay. Well, there's a cost to politicizing medicine and science, as if we didn't have that brought home to us during COVID. Carrie Mendoza is an emergency room physician here in Chicagoland. She's also involved with FAIR, the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. She put together this little video for her organization, in promotion of their pro-human medicine push, pro-human medicine, not pro-particular political party or ideology. And some great historical perspective as well as personal perspective. Mm-hmm. And she includes a little riff on youth gender dysphoria. But let's just start with some history as well as personal history with Dr. Mendoza that informs her views and see where you would like to come down. You want to be with Joe Biden and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and these trans pushers, or with Dr. Carrie Mendoza?
I recall a particularly memorable day working in the emergency department. A patient came in with a laceration on his face. Upon examining him, something became immediately obvious. This man was a Nazi. I'm a Jew. Despite my personal feelings, I never thought to let my emotions affect my duty to provide excellent care to this patient. Physicians dedicate years of training to help people flourish. That's everything we exist to do. But I worry that I'm watching my profession fail to live up to that principle and cause serious harm to the patients we are tasked with caring for. This would not be the first time something like this has happened. In Nazi Germany, the medical establishment got captured by fascist devaluation of those labeled as subhuman Untermensch, leading to sterilization, cruel medical experimentation, and murder. During the Cultural Revolution in China, admission to medical schools and hiring at hospitals was determined by political allegiance rather than competence. Their hospitals became known for suffering and death. The Islamic Republic of Iran is a leading nation in sex change operations, which are forced on homosexuals due to their religion's prohibition on homosexuality. Even within a free Western society, When an illiberal ideology takes off within a profession, questioning it can lead to negative repercussions, incentivizing conformity. People were severely harmed and killed by ideologies that saw people as groups rather than as individuals. Racism fueled the Tuskegee syphilis study, where Black Americans were intentionally left untreated for a deadly and debilitating disease. Native American women were unnecessarily sterilized. The eugenics movement started here in America, inspiring the Nazis, and was widely popular with the era's progressive movement. I worry that a new, unquestionable, illiberal ideology is conquering my profession, continuing to seek to treat people as members of groups rather than as individuals.
And she's not alone. A former University of Pennsylvania Med School Associate Dean, Dr. Stanley Goldfarb, has been writing about this in the pages of the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere for years, talking about the politicization of med schools and, by extension, medicine. We talked to Dr. Marty McCarry yesterday from Johns Hopkins. What did he say? The top three priorities of the medical and public health establishment are today?
One was global warming.
Right, climate change.
Climate change. That's the same thing.
Dye.
That's right, dye directors.
Yeah.
Like the one that was celebrated from SVB Bank in Times Square. That's so
right.
The
priorities, as he detailed, they have nothing to do with quality of care. They have nothing to do with cost of care. They have a lot to do with exactly what Dr. Mendoza is talking about, group identity. And you don't treat groups, you treat individual patients. She reminds us what happens. I mean, she just did what happens when you start treating people like groups, and then you start rank ordering their importance, the importance of their existence by group. That's what you want to do? As if it's not been done before. Treating people as groups, not individual patients, you know, like we did during COVID.
In the interest of so-called health equity, life-saving treatments for COVID-19 were distributed in numerous states, in part based on skin color, denying treatment to Americans with the wrong skin color, who were more sick than others. In many jurisdictions, vaccine distribution was also rationed with racial preferences. Attempting to question all of this risks getting one falsely labeled as a racist and shunned as a consequence. We can create better health outcomes by looking deeper to find the risk factors that vary between populations and directing care to those at the greatest risk, regardless of socially constructed groups.
And on the topic we've been discussing, youth gender dysphoria, well, here are some of the more important studies on the topic amid the celebration and push of kids in this direction, the social contagion aspect of it that's so obvious given the exponential increase in identification in the last several years.
There is also the orthodoxy that only one treatment for youth gender dysphoria, affirmation, hormones, surgery, is the correct one, regardless of the individual conditions that might have led them to their discomfort with their body. Mastectomies are being performed on children as young as 15 as part of routine transgender healthcare. So-called gender-affirming hysterectomies have been performed on minors as well. Asking if there are other better ways for certain patients reporting gender dysphoria is often treated as transphobic, as advocating conversion therapy or pushing dysphoric children into suicide. Never mind the rate of regret and detransition increasing to amounts that haven't yet been properly studied. Multiple studies have shown that medical transition has no effect in reducing suicide rates, and two studies show post-operative transgender people have considerably higher risk for suicidal behavior. Some states are passing misinformation bills that would ban medical professionals from speaking in ways that contradict contemporary scientific consensus, unaware of how wrong previous medical consensus was that sought to cure homosexuality or treat female hysteria with oophorectomies and how wrong we might yet discover we are in the present.
And so the remedy for this politicization of medicine?
We need pro-human medicine that benefits all patients and understands the freedoms that are necessary to find truth. We must be allowed to question and challenge prevailing opinion, understanding that it is the only way to develop our knowledge. We must never let unquestionable illiberal orthodoxies prevent the saving of lives and the healing of illness. We must follow the message of the civil rights movement by treating everyone equally as individuals without regard to their immutable characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Die in banking, you lose your money. Die in medicine, you lose your life. Your kids. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Take it down a notch, everybody. Gather around your radios.
This is the Tiger Woods installment of Why Dan Proft is Single. You saw, I'm sure by now, have heard that Tiger, world's best golfer, I mean, not at present, but...
But he was.
For sure. Maybe the best golfer of all time.
Yeah.
Jack Nicklaus, I get it. It's an argument. But anyway, you saw he broke up with his girlfriend, Erica Herman.
Yeah.
Of 6 years, and... Now she's filed suit against a trust for $30 million, and she is trying to get out of an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, she signed in 2017 when they started dating.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I will tell you, when he started dating her, the first thing I thought, and I hope you guys don't pass judgment on me, but I don't care anymore, was, oh, my God, he could do so much better.
Oh, wow. Why? Because she worked at a restaurant he owned in Jupiter?
Yeah, she was just a manager, right? Or was she a hostess?
Something like that.
What's
wrong with that?
He could get supermodels and superstars. Like, Lindsay Vonn was perfect for him. I thought they were the perfect couple.
He didn't listen enough, she said. He's stubborn.
Is that what she said?
That's what she said.
That is the greatest way to break up with someone. I had no idea she said that.
Yeah,
I like her
that.
Even more now.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then
yeah.
She, you know, so apparently they took her.
He's set in his ways. Oh, really? You didn't know that going in?
I know. Most men are. They're not going to change. So if you think you're going to get a man and change him, you are not going to do
that. Oh, no, I know. That's what Rachel Uchtel said, that a tiger doesn't change his stripes.
Oh, my God. Oh,
and now she's got some podcast, and she's bringing Erica Herman on to talk about it.
She is?
Whatever she can talk, whatever Erica Herman thinks she can talk about.
Well, so Erica Herman...
Rachel Uchtel was this, you know, like a hostess, bar hostess that he hooked up with when he was married to Eileen, and she was one of those that came out during the height of the scandal over his infidelity and subsequent divorce, in case people are having to dust it off their scorecards from back in the day. But, yeah, so that's where that's at. Here's my question.
Yes.
In an era where sort of marriage is less and less attractive to more and more people, will the NDA become the new prenup?
Oh.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text.
So he broke up with her and he wanted to get her out of the house. So how they got her out of the house was they told her to pack for a vacation. And then his people took her to the airport, and they're like, there's no vacation, and you're out. So
that's right.
I mean, kind of a rough way to go, but, I mean, you got to go. You got to go. It's over, you know? Suck it up, buttercup. Move on. But this whole $30 million suing him and then, I think, making up, like, sexual harassment or sexual abuse to get out of the NDA is kind of slimy.
She didn't do that yet, but she inquired.
She inquired
about it. Yeah, as like a legal strategy. If you invoke sexual abuse or sexual harassment, then it could obviate the NDA. She has not made any specific allegations of harassment or abuse, but looking for an angle in like that, yes, it is pretty shady, isn't it?
It just makes me sick. Like, why do that to him? He's been through so much, and he gave you so much. He gave you a place to live. I'm sure he bought you nice gifts and flew you all over the world. And, you know,
I didn't expect you to be such a Tiger apologist. He's too good for her. Secondly, he's been through so much.
He has been.
Wow, look at you rallying to the fence of Tigre.
Leave the guy alone. And she knew what she was getting into, but $30 million? I mean, come on. And, you know, she must know how much he's worth and what's in his trust, and she's going after that. I just think that that's
right. She lived in the house with him. I think she has an idea how much he's worth, as does everybody else. But anyway, yes, but also, too, before, and so he says, well, oh, she's just thrown out and she doesn't have anywhere to go. His lawyer, Woods' lawyer, said that he made arrangements for her to stay at some luxury resort in the area and gave her money towards a house, undisclosed number, but whatever. So...
But that's a pretty good deal, Dan.
It's not bad.
I mean, when you break up with people, what do you do? Here's $10, go call a cab.
I never, right. When people dump me, I don't get any cash and prizes.
Yeah,
exactly,
I don't
right.
either. Doesn't happen. Yeah. When I dump people, I don't get any cash or prizes.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing about this, though, too. I just love the one-sidedness of this. So this story comes out, and then what's next, especially in the tabloids? Quote unquote flawed, quote unquote heartless. A look back at Tiger Woods' dating history. Right. So now we have, because Erica Herman and him broke up and she's trying to get whatever she can get. Uh-huh. Now we have to go, he's flawed. He's heartless. And this is like the observation of what's that guy's name? Kurt Sampson, who wrote some books on Woods. He probably said to people who work for him, hey, I've got this problem, you take care of it. So perfunctory and heartless to me. Oh, right, Kurt. He's so heartless. Oh, yeah. What's a good way to do it? Especially if you're Tiger Woods and you have to worry about exposure and shakedowns and phony allegations. You have to have witnesses. You want it to do like a throwdown in the house and have police called again with the her waving around Eileen's 7-iron. Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's no other way to do it. I mean, she wouldn't leave, so that's why they said you're going on vacation.
Yeah.
I still can't
right.
believe that. That's kind of if she really, would have that's done a the, good move.
If she would have done the Chris Stapleton, I should probably leave, then he wouldn't have needed to have her whisked to the airport and then locked out and then change the locks while she's gone.
Yeah, change the locks. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's just heartless. How about whorish? And I'm not talking about Erica Herman,
to talk about Horace. Let's talk about him.
Well, but I mean, it's just like, oh, you know, the guy is Tiger is heartless, but the women, and I'm not necessarily speaking about Erica Herman. I'm not passing any judgment on her other than on what she's trying to do with this lawsuit.
Shaking him down.
But I mean, these other women, you know, during the scandal period. Like they're all victims.
They asked for it. They were consensual partners, and then they all got paid for it. So that makes them whores.
Well,
right? You pay for sex, you're a whore.
I don't even need to do this segment. You just do it for me.
Sorry.
I mean, honestly, I thought I was going to get some Erica Herman defense, and
no.
You're completely in Tigray's camp.
Ela Nordegren, I loved her. You know, she's Swedish. Come on, what's not to love?
Well,
but she was classy about everything, and she doesn't spill the beans about their relationship. She's, you know, she has some decorum and respect for her family and for herself, so she doesn't go out and do tell all things.
Right. And you can understand why Tiger would be worried about that. Look, it's like, oh, it's just a prenup. Oh, it's a sign an NDA to date Tiger. That's ridiculous. Is it?
No,
because
it's not.
Because then, you know, you go sideways, the relationship goes sideways, and then you don't know. And then Erica Herman's on Dr. Phil saying how mean Tiger was to me or something like this, and he doesn't need it. He doesn't need a scandal, the headache. Yeah, he's just he can't date anybody because he's got to worry about repercussions if it doesn't work out.
I feel bad for Tiger. Leave him alone.
Exactly.
It's time. I spent a day with him. Do you know that? We were at Jackson Park. His dad was there, and I was a young Cub reporter at Channel 5, and he was there, and he was lovely. We had a blast. But his dad would always come in like, you two, what's going on? I'm just talking to him.
Yeah.
Under a tent.
Right.
You know, no alcohol's involved. We're just talking.
He saw what you were trying to do. He saw you were sidling up. You saw the dollar signs in your eyes. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm all about the Benjamins. Yeah.
Man, holy cow, did Tiger dodge a bullet there?
Please stop. I'm a lot older than him.
Thank God for Earl.
Yes, Earl came in. But Earl was, man, he
you're not
talk
that much
about.
You're not that much older than him.
No, how much?
He's in the late 40s now.
Yeah, that's true. But his dad was very controlling. I've never met somebody so controlling in my life. He watched him like a hawk. He made sure he, you know, took pictures with the right people. It was, it was kind of strange. I felt bad for him.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why we formed a bond.
I need a guardian angel like Earl Woods in my life. Ryan New Lenox, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, be honest. Tiger Woods borrowed this move from you. Hey, honey, I moved to Naples. I sold the place in the Lake Point Tower. You can't come home. It's over.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. I appreciate that. Appreciate the support.
It'd be a great story, but you lived alone. Darn it.
Yeah. But if I was going to do that move, I would have said, like, Belize or someplace I'm actually not. Dave and Racine.
Greetings and salutations. Yes. Well, at least Tiger had the decency just to send the head of his people, send this current paramour to the airport into a luxury resort. At least he didn't take her to the train station, a reference to Yellowstone.
Oh, I get the reference.
Wyoming borderline.
Thanks for the call, Dave. I get the reference. That's right. It could be a lot worse, Erica. Right, you could be on a Yellowstone ranch.
He's not a murderer.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I mean, if they won't leave, I just think that's a very creative way to get somebody out of your house and then change the locks. It's brilliant. But can you imagine she's sitting there and they're like, yeah, sorry, there is no vacation and you're locked out of the house.
Well, apparently,
now, we'll take you to this resort.
Apparently, there's been some friction in their relationship for several months, according to the reporting on this. And you know, there's this, of course, feeding frenzy of tabloid gossip columnists.
Well, what's going on?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the particulars.
What kind of
it's
friction,
just sort of
Dan?
Generally described. He probably is not listening enough. He's probably too stubborn. He probably is not paying enough attention to her. You know, the usual. He's too focused on himself and so on and so forth, right? The usual laments. I'm sure guys listening are familiar with such complaints.
And people keep saying, and she stayed with him after his accident when he almost lost his leg. Well, yeah, because she loved him. I'm sure she loved him.
I'm
but
sure.
But that doesn't mean you stay with somebody because they helped you through an illness.
Right. You can love but not like. Isn't that profound?
Did you just make that up? Because that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I can, because I love somebody, but I don't like them anymore. So that's good. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm writing it down. Can I make a T-shirt out of it?
Feel free to use it. Yeah, well, yeah, as long as I get some royalties.
Okay.
Yeah, we really should open a novelty shop with all of my aphorisms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could make big bank. You could be the spokesmodel. I'll come up with the aphorisms.
Got the hands. I'm ready.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, Dan, you know, when I was a teenager, same age as you, one of my favorite movies was Wall Street. I don't know if you remember the scene when Charlie Sheen gets his new, really nice apartment on the Upper West Side, New York, and that song by Talking Heads, "This Must Be the Place," was the song they had in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Did you play that? Did you play that when you got your place in Lake Point Tower?
No, what I reenacted, not the scene from Wall Street. I more reenacted the scene from American Psycho. When Christian Bale has the chainsaw and he's talking about Huey Lewis and sports. Never convicted, Frank. Never convicted. Thanks for the call. The NDA, I'm still sort of fascinated. You don't necessarily have to be a celebrity or even somebody that's wealthy to want an NDA because you don't want someone to disparage you afterwards. And this can go in both directions.
Well, you know, but, that's why mainly on social media, they could say something. But if you sign an NDA, you got to keep it clean.
Yeah, I mean, it's mainly the grievances mainly come from the distaff side, I would say, as a general rule. I don't know if you're on board with that, too, since you're such so pro-man in these things, which I really appreciate. It's nice to have the backup here.
That's all right. It's, you know,
but, yeah, the end.
Call it
the
like
end,
I see it.
The NDA is something that's really intriguing to me.
Would you sign one?
I don't know.
I'd sign one.
I don't need to sign one because I don't talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, you can't tell us why you broke up with Susie?
Yeah, right.
What happened there?
I, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Because you know what? I think it's embarrassing to the family. Some things you need to keep secret. And, you know, not secret, but you just don't need to tell everybody about your business.
I don't know why people are like to do that. Especially, I mean, and again, there's some guys I know that are like that. I don't, you know, I don't care. Stop talking about it. Not interested. But I mean, women, you know, the coffee clutches and the you know, I don't know, the venom that has to be expelled in order for them to move on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe that's just my personal experience.
Go to yoga. You'll get through it. Down dog it.
Kevin Northfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I don't know if this can improve your golf game or not, but if you think about it, Tiger Woods had a wife. He had 18 girlfriends. He was at the top of the golf world.
Yeah.
Each of these girlfriends thought that they were the other woman. They all knew he was married, but they didn't know there were 18 girlfriends. They thought they were the other woman. Then it all blows up. But my point is, he now has no wife. He has no girlfriends. He stinks as a golfer. Before, he was great. If you know your Bible, Dan, who is the smartest guy in the Bible? It's Solomon. Solomon had 400 wives and 600 concubines. Check it out. I'm not making this up. The smartest man in the Bible, 400 wives, 600 concubines. Solomon couldn't even shoot par over 36 holes.
Hi-o. Thanks for the call, Kevin.
400 wives.
Hey. Yeah.
Is that true? I should read my Bible.
Why, Dan? What is the takeaway here? I mainly just wanted to talk about this NDA thing, but how does, like, why Dan Proft is single is because, on this one, is because, well, I mean,
because women are evil.
That's it. Exactly. Thank you for saying it. You've been great in this segment. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The search for cultural middle ground. This is the topic of a recent column from our friend Dominic Green over at the Washington Examiner, which we'll get to in just a moment. But the search for cultural common ground. Cultural common ground.
What does that mean?
On the issue of abortion, for example.
Okay.
Where is the cultural common ground? Has Jane Fonda, Hanoi Jane, did she identify it when she said this on The View?
We have experienced many decades now of having agency over our body, of being able to determine when and how many children to have. We know what that feels like. We know what that's done for our lives. We're not going back. I don't care what the laws are. We're not going back.
I think the women will rise up.
That's the activist.
That's Jane
speaking. Yeah. And she probably will get a Nobel Prize.
But it's
very,
the truth.
It is the truth.
We're not going to do it.
Besides marching and protesting, what else do you suggest?
Well, it doesn't happen overnight. It's not a miraculous. What did you say?
Murder.
What? Wait a second. She's just kidding.
Don't say that. That's
you don't know. They'll pick up on that and just run with it.
Yeah, that's the worst.
She's just kidding. It's
well. Let me talk to you about. So funny.
She's just kidding. And then when one of those man-hating shrews said she's just kidding, Jane Fonda just gave her a look with like eyebrows raised, like no, I'm not. So where is the common ground to be found with the pro-abort left that dismisses the rule of law? The law is just a sword or shield, depending on their interests. Did Glenn Youngkin, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, did he identify the middle ground when he offered this response to a dude pretending to be a woman, asking him at a CNN town hall last week about bathroom usage?
Look at me. I am a transgender man. Do you really think that the girls in my high school would feel comfortable sharing a restroom with me?
So first of all, Nico, thank you for, again, asking the question, being here tonight, and engaging in this important discussion. I believe first, when parents are engaged with their children, then you can make good decisions together, and I met your dad, and I'm glad that you're both here together. That's really, really important. I also think that there are lots of students involved in this decision, and what's most important is that we try very hard to accommodate students. That's why I have said many, many times, we just need extra bathrooms in schools. We need gender-neutral bathrooms, and so people can use a bathroom that they, in fact, are comfortable with.
I think I misspoke. It was a woman pretending to be a dude, right? It said trans man. Woman pretending to be a dude. So is that the cultural middle ground there? I think this question is more complicated than it sounds. Dominic Green is a columnist for the Washington Examiner, contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and author of The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. Dominic, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hello, Dan. Hello, Amy.
Good to have you. So you wrote this piece that's sort of right versus left on these cultural touchstones and its enforcement on the one hand, the left, its eradication, on the other hand, on the right. And there is still cultural middle ground to be forged between these two poles. On, you know, to take whichever one you want, Jane Fonda or Glenn Youngkin, any of them getting close to that middle ground?
Well, no, they're not really. The problem is this. There are things that we wish we could eradicate, but the toothpaste is out of the tube. We wish we could eradicate nuclear weapons. We wish we could eradicate fentanyl. We wish we could eradicate reality TV. But none of these things are within the grasp of government. Therefore, the only thing we can do is to regulate. And it's important that the law actually serves the people on these questions. The United States is a simultaneous experiment in different forms of government at the state level. And the only way to arrive at some kind of situation which serves the desires of the people is to allow states to regulate according to the voters' wishes. The case of transgender laws is, of course, in the news this week because President Biden has said it would be almost a sin to pass the law that Governor DeSantis wants it to pass to ban transgender surgeries for under 18 in Florida. But it's interesting, of course, that Governor DeSantis is not trying to ban all transgender surgeries in Florida. In other words, if you're a consenting adult and can convince people that you're not insane, you can actually obtain these surgeries in Florida. So that would seem to me to be an example of the middle ground. And another question that we should bear in mind in this, the fact that something wrong is regulated does not mean we should necessarily feel obliged to celebrate it, to applaud it. And there's something in Governor Youngkin's response there, which I think is rather squeamish about the basics of this. As far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as the vast majority of people are concerned, a young person who has believed that they are born in the wrong body is not suffering from a physiological condition. They're suffering from a mental condition. And there is a great deal of evidence to suggest that they have actually been grievously misled. And I'm not talking about the tiny, tiny number of people who are born with chromosomal variations that are medically known as intersex. These people, of course, need precisely the kinds of techniques that are available and precisely the kind of regulation that should exist. I'm talking about the vast majority of cases. And a fascinating report came out last week by the sociologist Jonathan Haidt, Greg Lukianoff. It showed three things. One of them, that the people, the teenagers who want these kinds of brutal treatments are overwhelmingly female. So it's not equally distributed between boys and girls, which is what we would expect. They are overwhelmingly liberal, which, as far as I'm aware, is not a physiological condition. It's a psychological condition. And they have heavy social media use. And those three things, female liberal social media use, are what shape the typical candidate for these kind of medical procedures. But that is so obviously cultural, not biological, that we really do need to slow down and, if not stop entirely, and think about what we're allowing very powerful pharma and medical companies to do to children.
Well, what are the rules in the UK when it comes to kids wanting to transition and have top and bottom surgery? Is there an age limit?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, the UK started in the same way as the US now is, which is basically shunting people very quickly for getting a specialist referral and dosing them with hormones immediately, allowing 13, 14-year-olds to self-identify as male or female, regardless of their biology. The result was the same kind of catastrophe as has happened in the US. The difference is that the government in the UK has actually issued a directive to family doctors who, if they are, if a teenager comes to their office and says, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy, the doctor's instruction is basically to say, you're a teenager, life is confusing, go home and take a break and stay off the internet. Literally that, as in not taking it seriously, because this is a psychological mass panic. It is not a genuine biological condition. So I know Americans are remarkable people, but they are certainly not a different species. The U.S. is on a very different track to any other Western government on this, and the Democrats in particular are committed to transition. And I recommend, I won't go into the details because some of the listeners will be having their breakfast still, but I recommend they look up online exactly what these surgeries involve and what they look like, because they are extreme, they are destructive. And by the way, they're presented as being a one-off, but they're not. To sustain the fiction that a biological girl is actually a boy requires lifetime treatments with hormones and often heavily invasive surgeries through the patient's lifetime. In other words, this creates customers, captive customers for life, for pharma and private medicine.
Well, and all you have to do is listen to some who have detransitioned are expressing deep regret about the decisions they made. Some even suing because they moved in this direction as an adolescent, suing medical professionals for never questioning what was going on in their heads. And by the way, in the UK, the health service there closed that Tavistock gender child gender identity clinic last year because of poor outcomes for patients.
Exactly. That's the other thing. And we have the same data here in the US as everywhere else. There is not much evidence to suggest that the suicide rate among people suffering from gender dysphoria is changed by all of the pain and suffering of surgeries and so on. The suicide rate afterwards is pretty much the same as the suicide rate before. In other words, this is a mental condition. It is not treatable by surgery.
And so here's the thing, though, as you know, Jane Fonda, she wants to murder pro-lifers. I mean, that's just the, you know, rabid, unhinged pro-abort left. But Youngkin, that answer. And this is where so-called conservatives get tripped up. They want to forge that middle ground that you're describing. But they think the way to do that is by starting from the premise of the left. So Youngkin saying gender neutral, go to whichever bathroom you're comfortable using. Well, that starts from the premise of the trans, you know, identitarians. And if you start from their premises, you eventually get to their outcomes. You're not forging any middle ground. You're just slowly ceding that ground to your erstwhile political opponents.
Yes, because Youngkin is talking as it's taken as read that this person will be a high schooler who has already transitioned, as they say. And that, of course, is precisely not what the vast majority of Americans want, or the vast majority of people anywhere. He's assuming that this medical industrial process, which is destroying the lives of teenagers, particularly girls, he's assuming that that's all in place and that really it's just a big debate about what kind of public restrooms install or whether to put a porta potty in the car park, as if it can be sort of papered over in this way. That's not it at all. The fundamental assumptions that he is accepting are insupportable medically and logically, and they are also insupportable at the ballot box. The voters simply do not agree with it. Now, if the Democrats wish to campaign on the rights of teenagers to surgery and drag queen story hour, they can, of course, try it. I don't think that it's a big winner for 2024, and I don't really see much point in Republicans playing along to it. I don't think that they should be cruel necessarily, but I think the public knows perfectly well what the basic facts are here biologically. And they know perfectly well that we have a situation where the law is not functioning as it should, that pharma companies in particular are highly influential and they are able to bend the law to their purposes.
Setting candidates aside for a second, because you know one of the gaps I see with respect to the conservative landscape is an intellectual gap. We don't do a good enough job getting upstream of candidates, making the arguments and prosecuting the cases such that candidates then can pick up what has been laid down and run with it and tailor it to their particular constituency and so forth. The left is perpetual motion messaging through all of the institutions they control. We don't control as many institutions. We don't have as many channels, but we do have some. And I don't know that we use those as effectively as we could on these cultural issues or, frankly, economic issues, or what our messaging is going to be in the light of the bank failures and so forth. We're so candidate focused where the left is culture focused.
I think that is true. And the left has played a long game, which is the march through the institutions and appealing to fairness. Of course, it's not going to get anywhere. But appealing to common sense does. I think if the president of the United States says, as he did this week, that it's a sin, almost a sin, to ban transitioning teenagers, I think this really creates the opening, as you're saying, to go upstream of particular candidates and talk about the fundamentals. Because this is a fundamentals question. This is not a party politics question. It's absolutely about the basic assumptions that people have and the basic facts about human biology and whether they're going to be living in a system which is telling them to their face that these basic facts are simply not true. It's like telling people the world is flat and there will be some kind of punishment if you were to observe that it's round.
He is Dominic Green, columnist for The Washington Examiner, contributor to The Wall Street Journal, author of The Religious Revolution, The Birth of Modern Spirituality, 1848 to 1898. Dominic, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law. For 30 plus years running, he's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. And with the Safety Act before the state Supreme Court, crime is top of mind and continues to be. Obviously, it's the backdrop of the mayor's runoff as well. Terry Duffy is the head of the CME Group, Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group. In a podcast the other day, he said this: 3 o'clock in the afternoon, my wife got carjacked right in the city of Chicago. And it's absolutely insane what's going on here. 90% of the carjackings in Chicago are done by juveniles. So the juveniles go in and they come right back out literally in an hour. He said he had a conversation with Lightfoot over violence and that her response was the homicide rate is falling. He said to that response, I said, don't go there. Please don't go there. One is too many. Yeah. He also, of course, cited crime as the reason that one of the reasons why it's difficult to get people to come back to work, why a lot of businesses are looking for the exits. He also grew up in Chicago, went to school in Chicago. It was a tough time growing up in Chicago, so yes, we've been on our back foot a few times, but I think we try to move forward, and hopefully we can do it again. Yeah. Well, you know, of course it's terrible that Terry Duffy's wife was victimized, but I also hasten to add that the city's corporate titans, including Terry Duffy, share the blame with the politicians, the schools, the media, the voters, for the quote-unquote insane Chicago crime about which he speaks, don't they? This is as detestable and incompetent and off-putting as Lori Lightfoot is and was, past tense, and she's on her way out, hardly begins and ends with her. Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org. Thanks for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. Just a quick stat on that homicide number that Lightfoot keeps pitching is going down. We are still 64%. You know, so this year to date compared to 2019 when she took over, we're 64% higher in homicides today than we were then. So, you know, this stuff isn't over. And crimes this year alone, year-to-date compared to last year, right, which last year was already huge. We're 47% up on that. So, this crime problem isn't going away. But to your point about the corporate elite, it's something that I've been bothered by, you know, even before COVID, because it's not just now. It's not just on the whole, you know, the woke ideology that's been going on. It was before that on finances. The corporate elite could have gotten together. They're an extremely powerful group. You know, you're talking about some of the corporate titans of America, and they could have easily put a lot of pressure on the leaders here to fix things, whether it was pensions or just the overall, you know, lies that are perpetuated through the budgets. And they never did.
And now
it's worse.
And public safety, too. I mean, you know, I remember people, you know, just go back to Rahm. I mean, we had 800 murders a year under Rahm. I remember people saying, because I was one of them, saying, you know, you think the city can burn down around the downtown, the revenue-producing districts, and it'll never reach the downtown. If you think that, then you are deluding yourself. It will. I don't know when it's going to come, sort of like the pension math. I don't know when the math will capsize the Chicago Police Pension Fund, for example, or the Firefighters Pension Fund. But I know it's going to happen because I know the math. I don't know when it's going to happen that the violence that's endemic to the west and south sides will be visited downtown and on the north side. But I know it's going to happen because I see the response to this threat that is present. And so the pandemic hastened what was already afoot. And here we are.
Well, yeah. And it is very clear to see, too, Dan, because you know, we used to, in Chicago, L.A., and New York, used to have really high murder rates. We all had pretty high murder rates. And then there was a huge divergence. You know, New York started following its broken windows policing. And the rates there collapsed. And L.A. also did more community policing, and their rate collapsed. And we went the other way. We went back up again. And, you know, we reported recently that we had five times a higher murder rate in Chicago than in New York. And so to your point about what you were saying, and then it becomes obvious, is like, you can't have murder rates that high and then not expect it to come into your – at some point, right? And it happens at some point, and it takes triggers. It takes some kind of event, and, you know, Laquan McDonald type event, and then, of course, you had George Floyd. It starts coming into other areas where people start to care, but by then it becomes too late, and it's precisely what's happening right now.
Now the wrong people are getting carjacked, Ted. the wrong people
yeah,
are.
It, now it matters.
Is right? Is there a right? Is there mm-hmm. a right person? You know that's the problem with a stratified city by race and income and ideology and everything else. That's how it works. It's a progression, and now it's happening to the wrong people, and so there's a little bit of hair on fire. Okay, I get it, and I don't want it to happen to anybody, but let's trace the origins of this, so if we are going to chart a different path, that we truly chart a different path. We don't just paper over what's transpired to date where we are currently and say, oh, well, everything's fine now because Paul Vallis is on the fifth floor. No, everything's not fine, and it's not going to be fine, and it's not going to be fine for a long time because there's a lot to unwind and a lot to fix. It just matters now because it's come to the Mag Mile. It's come to the Financial District. It's come to Lincoln Park and Lakeview. Now it matters.
Well, and this is why I'm so concerned about, no matter who takes over, incrementalism. You can't have these little incremental changes in policy to make things a little bit better. And you know, that's why we need much stronger voices across the board, not just from, again, a guy like Vallis, but also from the corporate elite, because it
Absolutely.
Can't be we just roll back some things, right? Because that doesn't change things. That only, like, stops the bleed a little bit. But so we need much bigger reforms, and that's why I'm still waiting to hear a guy like Paul Vallis take on Kim Fox, Tim Evans, Safety Act. And that's what I'd like to hear, because that would let me as a voter, I'm not a voter in Chicago, but me as a person who cares about Chicago and, you know, goes there a lot. I want to hear that we're going to do the structural changes to fix things, not just, you know, stem the bleed a little bit.
Well, Brandon Johnson came out yesterday and said, you know, made this declaration. I never said don't defund the police.
I've gone through the police budget. I believe we have 4 graphic designers on the payroll. Now, maybe somehow graphic designers keep us safe. They might.
So, you know, it's not that he wants to defund police. He just wants to cut the police budget and get rid of graphic designers.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of the commentary. My colleague Matt Rosenberg wrote a piece this morning about, you know, Brandon's own words. You know, and he's out there. You know, he was very direct about what he wanted, you know, in 2020 about, you know, he said that defunding the police is not a slogan. It's an actual real political goal.
Right.
You know, he said that he wanted to reduce the sheriff's budget in 2020 as a Cook County commissioner. He said there's no number big enough in terms of cuts. So he's kind of coming back and maybe CPD doesn't need 4 graphic designers, but that's just, he's grabbing on to things that, that sound good. But, you know, he's got a record of saying it in a city where, you know, we did that poll a couple years ago. 80% of Chicagoans wanted the same amount or more policing in their neighborhoods.
Wow.
So in a city where more policing is needed and wanted, you know, he's had a goal of defunding, and he needs to square that up. His own words, he has to square that up with what he's saying now.
Well, no, he doesn't. I mean, you know, again, why should Brandon Johnson be disallowed from telling beautiful lies? Everybody else does, including all of those the leading lights of all those institutions I just mentioned, the media, the unions, the schools, the political class, the corporate elite, they all tell beautiful lies. Why can't Brandon Johnson tell his?
Yeah, no, I stand corrected, Dan. He doesn't need to fix it. I think it just needs to be called out, and that's exactly what we're doing at Wirepoints. You know, let's put his words against what he's saying now.
Absolutely. Good news, though. This will start to shore things up in a hurry. We're making a play for the Democrat National Convention next year in Chicago. I can't wait for all those leftists to get to drink from the glass that is Chicago. If they were to decide to locate the convention here, I can't imagine that the image makers really want the backdrop of Chicago for their convention. But of course, Jelly Belly and his ambitions, he wants to bring the convention to Chicago and says, no problem. We can afford it. I guess he's going to personally guarantee it.
Well, you know, he kind of buys everything he wants, right? We're just talking about that yesterday. He bought his own elections twice, you know, spending over $100 million each time. He you know, paid for Bailey's campaign, right, whatever much that was. He, of course, the big piece of the news is he paid for a couple judges to get elected, $1 million each. You know, he pays out of his own pocket for people to work for him in the governor's office, and that, of course, bastardizes the relationship between government and him. So why not just buy the convention? He wants to run for president, or at least that's the feeling. And you know, if you watch his actions and his words across the country, he wants to run. So maybe for him, what a better platform to get things started and have the DNC here.
Well, completely, you know, he's got lots of people around him that are for sale.
You better get some stores on Michigan and State Street and Michigan Avenue.
He can lease out those spaces too. You know, he's a tech entrepreneur. Don't forget.
Fascinating. Think about it. What he gets to pitch to the rest of the country, and of course, only one half of the country. He's got the biggest green policy in the country. He's got the strongest gun ban in the country. Of course, they'll just have to go through the courts. He's got the Safety Act. He's got the abortion bill. He's got the immigration agenda, his CRT agenda. I mean, the list is long, and of course, he's got the best finances in the country now. So that's what he wants to pitch. Of course, he's going to have to counter that with all the mess that he would have in Chicago potentially if it comes here.
Yeah, they voted yesterday family leave for whatever reason. You don't even have to give a reason. 40 hours.
One of the biggest family leave, one of the biggest family leave programs in the country.
Yeah, that made national news yesterday.
No,
he's got a lot to sell.
It's awesome. It's going to be very attractive to business. Also, this too, priorities of your suburban legislators in the General Assembly. Anybody paying attention to this? Anastava Murray out there in leafy Naperville, the best places to live in the country, I'm told. Huh? Except I know better. I grew up out that way. Anastava Murray sponsoring legislation that requires each school board shall provide LGBTQIA+ diversity training for educators who have not previously received it, mandating gender ideology indoctrination, train the trainer, so the teachers can turn around and impose it on the kids. Senator Karina Villa providing beginning next school year, LGBTQIA+ inclusivity training shall be required as part of professional development leadership training for school board members. The school board members get it. The teachers get it. Then the kids get it. Yeah. And you can understand the contents. I think we've talked about these things enough. Senator Ram Villivalam, $20 million to Department of Public Services to give grants to local school districts and community organizations for comprehensive sex ed for K-12. These are the priorities, right? Because this is what people say. I'm a fiscal conservative and a social lunatic. Sure you are. And so this is what your legislators, particularly your suburban ones, go down to Springfield and advance the rainbow flag. And that's the modus operandi of the left here. And that is their priority for all the talk about business and quality this and attractiveness that and opportunity this. This is what they're doing. This is their focus. And
and then don't forget the other one that this kind of cuts the legs out of parents. You've got LaShawn Ford putting out his bill that my colleague Mark Lennon just wrote about yesterday, and this creates the offense of parental bullying. So if
parental
a parent,
bullying. Yeah.
Yeah. So if a parent tries to discipline, embarrass, or alter the behavior of the minor, then that would coerce, intimidate, harass, or cause substantial emotional stress to their kid. It would create this crime called parental bullying. And so,
Disciplining your kid is a potential criminal offense now in Illinois. It's perfect.
That's right. So there you go. So get them from all angles, right? Get them at the schools, and then of course get them at home. So this is a tough place to do business as a parent.
LaShawn Ford on the West Side, the problem in his district and the problem in this state is parents disciplining their kids. And I assume that would start with disagreeing with their kids, because we know the kids are in charge. Whatever little Johnny and little Sally want, whatever little Johnny and Sally say they are, you better nod your head. Otherwise, Big LaShawn is coming for you. Oh, the state insinuating itself between parent and child. Gosh, what a surprise. Where have I seen and heard that before?
Well, and isn't that funny, right? Because the two biggest problems we have in Chicago are crime and education. And so if you wanted to punish your kid for not doing homework, or if you wanted to punish your kid for doing a violent act, well, is the state going to step in here?
No. Apparently, you cannot punish. Wait, so let's see. We don't punish I guess it makes sense. I guess that does logic flow. I'm trying to put my mind in LaShawn Ford's mind, and that's dangerous. But so since we don't discipline the juveniles for carjacking, we shouldn't discipline them for not doing their homework. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah,
I get it. Right? We're not going to discipline them for committing a violent act against somebody. Then we certainly shouldn't discipline them for the mere minor offense of not doing their homework. I mean, and what's the difference anyway? In Chicago, nobody can read or write as it is.
Well, and then we wonder why only 1 out of 10, black children can read at grade level in Chicago public schools. So it's a sad statement, but these are all the things that need to be flipped. It's just a question of when and how long does it take us to get there. But all this stuff, this kind of stuff needs to be flipped. All these laws have to be flipped upside down, and God knows when that's going to happen.
God knows. He's the only one. I certainly don't. Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks, as always, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
And I don't know if God knows, but Ted joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. And on Odyssey. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Here's what Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, said yesterday. And he got up at crack o' dawn to say it. Thank you so much.
The crack of dawn meaning 9 a.m.?
Mr. President. He doesn't do that. That's not me saying it. Okay. That's former White House spokesman Jen Psaki explaining.
Now, it's important to note, President Biden does nothing at 9 a.m. He is a night owl. So the fact that he is doing this at 9 a.m. anyway speaks to how vital the White House recognizes it is for him to have his voice out there conveying that to the American public.
All right, Steve.
Okay,
sure. So this is really important.
First of all, we should be thankful, express our gratitude, and that really conveys the weightiness of the situation, the importance that he's placing on it.
Yeah, somebody texted in, Biden's a night owl, as if he's always saying, who's getting my pudding? Who's reading me a story?
Right.
Who's changing my clothes?
Also reported last year by CNN that he's early to bed,
right,
and apparently late to rise. But, whatever. The important thing is he made the decision to get up and get to the podium before 9 o'clock yesterday. And here's what he said when he got there.
And here are the highlights. First, all customers who had deposits in these banks can rest assured. I want to rest assured they'll be protected and they'll have access to their money as of today. That includes small businesses across the country that bank there and need to make payroll, pay their bills, and stay open for business. No losses will be, and this is an important point, no losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Let me repeat that. No losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Instead, the money will come from the fees that banks pay into the deposit insurance fund. Because of the actions that our regulators have already taken, every American should feel confident that their deposits will be there if and when they need them. Second, the management of these banks will be fired. If the bank is taken over by FDIC, the people running the bank should not work there anymore. Third, investors in the banks will not be protected. They knowingly took a risk, and when the risk didn't pay off, investors lose their money. That's how capitalism works. And fourth, there are important questions of how these banks got into the circumstance in the first place. We must get the full accounting of what happened and why those responsible can be held accountable. In my administration, no one is above the law. And finally, we must reduce the risk of this happening again. During the Obama-Biden administration, we put in place tough requirements on banks like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, including the Dodd-Frank law to make sure that the crisis we saw in 2008 would not happen again. Unfortunately, the last administration rolled back some of these requirements.
Right. So the last part isn't relevant. The rollback on the Trump administration of the significant financial institution designation, and that's not me saying it. That's the Frank from Dodd-Frank, Barney Frank, saying it. Barney Frank.
Oh my God! Tell everybody.
A director at Signature Bank of New York, who was as surprised as anyone that regulators came in and shut down Signature Bank of New York, as the Wall Street Journal opined. Barney Frank getting a little education in what happens when the government doesn't like your business. Welcome to the rent-seeking party, Barney. So that's what Biden. So and so that's the capitalism thing. Investors made a bet and they lost, and that's capitalism. Oh, really? What about those clients of Silicon Valley Bank who knew the FDIC cap was $250,000, but had millions in their accounts anyway? Did they knowingly take a risk that didn't pan out because of a combination of the Fed policy, Fed regulatory oversight, and their own mismanagement? Is that part of capitalism too or not? Finally, the no taxpayers, no bailout. It's a backdoor bailout. The bank fees is just the beginning of it, but those bank fees that will be paid are going to turn around and be passed on to Johnny Punch Clock and Sally Housecoat in terms of higher bank fees. You pay. Middle income families, people pay by the rules, always get the bill. It is axiomatic. Don't believe this from any politician that somehow taxpayers that are not, you know, the rich and powerful are off the hook. You're never off the hook. You're always on the hook. And that was Charles Payne's point. Reacting right after the big guy got done speechifying, Charles Payne over at Fox Business had a great riff.
First and foremost, for me, this was a bailout of Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley Bank of Silicon Valley. And everyone needs to be clear on that.
I'm clear. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Jim Perry, founder, CEO. He's an executive. Perry International Capital Partners, LLC. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Your reaction to Charles Payne's response in terms of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank in particular?
I think he's 100% correct. Mm-hmm. This is a Silicon Valley bailout, and Charles Payne is right on the money.
Because we have people that were flying high when everything was going swell for Silicon Valley and the IPOs and the SPACs, as Charles Payne went on to talk about. And you saw Silicon Valley increase its deposits 300% when banks around the nation were seeing their deposit increases at about 30% over the same time period. And they got a little full of themselves, and they start, as Bernie Marcus said, they started thinking about politics and climate change and Swedish teenagers, and they forgot that bonds run inverse to interest rates, and they didn't appreciate the VC Twitterverse, and they got caught.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I feel bad for all of the companies that were actually doing the right thing and putting money on deposits at the bank and making payrolls and paying utility bills and stuff like that. But when some of these high-flying sort of crypto companies had deposited, you know, $300 million, $400 million on deposit at Silicon Valley Bank, and Silicon Valley Bank was really only paying about a half a percentage point for deposit rates, then they went out and bought a bunch of treasury bonds, probably, you know, I just looked at the numbers, average yield, they probably paid 2%, maybe as high as 4%. And they made a really big mistake. They got greedy and wanted to take all that spread for themselves. And they didn't have a risk management team that understood that interest rates can go up. So I find the whole thing slightly absurd.
And I just can't get over this. They're so greedy that most of them got bonuses the day before the FDIC came in and took over.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sick. This CEO there, he sold $30 million worth of stock in the last 3 months, as did other board members. And on Friday, there's 8,000 odd employees at SVP, and they got a performance bonus for 2022.
Well, sure, they were one of Forbes, the Forbes list. They made the Forbes list of best bank in America. Well, of course, they got a performance bonus.
It's amazing, though. You know, I mean, as to your point, Dan, you know, between 2021 and 22, the balance sheet of this bank went up by a factor of 3, right? And that's the fastest growing bank in the country by a huge margin. And the CEO of the bank was on the board of directors at the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank. And it really raises the question is like, you know, why did not anybody see this, right? I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that there's a tremendous amount of leverage and risk going on here. Yet somehow nobody did.
And what about the federal response now? I mean, the Wall Street Journal opining. So what are we going to do now with respect to the Fed and the president committing to back all of the uninsured deposits? So are we just going to create a guaranteed federal backing? I mean, you know, we're going to make the moral hazard that already exists bigger, and we're just going to have all deposits will be backed at all times for all reasons sort of policy?
Right. Well, the deposit insurance limit at the moment is $250,000. And just, you know, whatever, the last crisis, it was something like 100. But the point is that, you know, it's going to go up. And I think if the government wants sort of a central bank digital currency, you know, this is a great way to push this agenda, right? I mean, I think a lot of good businessmen will get some money back that maybe had deposits in there of $5 million or $10 million or even 50. But I really do think that this was an investment in Silicon Valley. And I think the stimulus that the government is going to put forward, and we don't know how much it's going to be, right? These deposits, maybe there's a special circumstance where some of these big companies get more, but this is a stimulus measure, right? This is more stimulus. This is the first stimulus since the pandemic. And if you look at things like options volatility and options activity at the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the activity in put options on the VIX are higher today than they were during the height of the pandemic.
Yesterday, regional banks got routed on the street. So what's the forecast for them?
Well, I had a friend call me and ask me if he should buy the regional bank index yesterday. And I said, man, oh, man, I don't know yet. We'll see. We'll know by more tomorrow. Let's wait and see. And, you know, this regional bank index was down 12%, the index yesterday. It's probably going to be up 12% today. I mean, stocks are going to open up. Spreads are tightening. The odds of a Fed tightening on the 22nd of March, which were essentially 90% that they would hike 50, you know, as of last Wednesday. Now it's only a 60% chance that they go 25. And, you know, you get to 50-50 at some point in the next week or so here, you're going to get a no hike. And risk assets are going to love it, right? It's more stimulus. And how big is the bailout for uninsured deposits? Is it a trillion? I don't know. Is it a half a trillion? Probably. But the fact is, that's another half a trillion dollars of government stimulus on top of everything that we've already had. So we're kind of right back where we were, you know?
That's a great point. Well, and speaking of right back where we were, so the CPI number out this morning, 6% inflation year over year, food inflation 9.5% year over year. So you're not really seeing the sort of decline, the trajectory, of decline that you want. And so how does that factor in what the Fed will do on the 22nd when they're sort of now between a rock and a hard place?
Right. You know, CPI, there's four line items that came through, and the month-on-month core number was actually up. The other ones were as expected. But, you know, inflation is still running hot, and more stimulus from the government means it's going to be hotter. So if the Fed really had the American public and the American economy as his top interest, they've still got to fight inflation. And I think inflation after this whole thing with the stimulus that we're going to get, I think the risk of it is higher. Let me put it this way. Back in the 70s, right, 70s and 80s, when interest rates were as high as they were, right, 10, 12, 14, 15, 20%, the last time inflation was this high, 1,600 banks failed, right? 1,600 banks failed, not three, 1,600. And the fast twitch response to the government on three small banks failing just goes to show you that this government, this administration, cares about control. And the more money that goes out of these small regional banks into the big ones allows them to do what they want. If this Silicon Valley Bank, which was something like $200 billion worth of assets under management, let's just say this bank was in the heartland of America, right? And it failed. Do you think the Fed would have bailed them out?
No.
Me either. So why did they do it? Charles Payne's right. This is a Silicon Valley bailout. It would never have happened.
But to your point, and this is a point that Chris Whalen made on our show yesterday too, is that you got a lot of other regional banks that have balance sheets that may be just as precarious. They may be bordering on insolvency too. It just hasn't been realized yet because their bond positions haven't matured. And so there could be a lot more to come. And so the Fed's got to worry about hiking rates and exacerbating that problem, or not hiking rates and exacerbating inflation. That's their choice.
That is true. And if you look at the numbers, and we've all seen them over the last 3 or 4 days, there's something like another $620 billion worth of losses on the books of these regional banks, which hasn't been booked, right? So you're looking at 10, 15, 20% asset values on these portfolios that are down. And the fact is that when interest rates went spiking up, those losses got worse. But, all of a sudden here, you've got bill rates back down to 4.92, and 2-year notes are at 4.25. They were at 4% yesterday. 2-year notes went from 5% to 4% in 2.5 days. Mm-hmm. And 10-year notes were down 75 basis points. So this rally in the bond market actually reduces the immediacy of another bailout because the exposures are smaller today by 20% than they were, Monday morning.
So what's your best guess? I know you gave us the handicapping at present for March 22nd, but even beyond March 22nd, is the Fed going to stay the course, do you think, with respect to the rate hikes and where they want to get the Fed funds rate ultimately, just get there slower?
As somebody who cares about the whole health of the whole economy, I think that they should hike 25 basis points. If they choose to not hike, the stock market's going to go up. Risk assets will get more highly priced. And that's, at the end of the day, that's what they're trying to stop, right? So the markets are kind of haywire here, but I think if you react and go back down to zero, you're sending a really, really dangerous message to risk takers and inflation.
And you're sticking it to the people who play by the rules that I opened the segment talking about.
Right.
Jim Perry, founder, CIO, Perry International Capital Partners. James, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yep, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we mentioned this legislation. Actually, Ted Dabrowski brought it up when we were talking to him last hour about all things Illinois policy related. The legislation that he mentioned, House Bill 29, would do the following. I'm reading from the synopsis posted on the Illinois General Assembly website. Creates the offense of parental bullying, provides that a parent or legal guardian of a minor commits parental bullying when he or she knowingly and with the intent to discipline, embarrass, or alter the behavior of the minor transmits any verbal or visual message that the parent or legal guardian reasonably believes would coerce, intimidate, harass, or cause substantial emotional distress to the minor.
Isn't that partially what parenting is? Am I wrong on this?
Parental bullying when he or she knowingly, with the intent to discipline, embarrass, or alter the behavior.
Oh, so making my son pick up garbage outside of Lakeview High School because he did something wrong is bullying? That's bad?
Any verbal or visual messaging.
Made him wear a safety jacket.
Anything. You can't say anything critical to your child about your child.
Okay.
That would be my interpretation of it. LaShawn Ford heard us talking about it, and he wanted to clarify the intent of the legislation, so we're happy to give him his say on it. LaShawn Ford, state rep, West Side, joins us now. West Side of the city joins us now. LaShawn, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan and Amy. Yes, I think it's important to note that, first of all, this idea came from a constituent, and I support the idea fully. And I believe that parents should be able to discipline their children to the full extent of the law. And I believe what this bill is doing is saying that you should not discipline your children and transmit it to social media. That has caused lots of problems for children's emotional growth. It's humiliating, and it's not appropriate to publicly shame a child on social media.
Well, give us an example.
Wait a second, though. This doesn't say on social media. Transmits.
It says transmits.
Well, transmits any verbal or visual message. Transmits. Well, if I discipline my fictional kid in the public square, that's transmitting that verbal discipline in a context where others can hear it. And so that could have the same impact as posting it on a social media site.
Well, a transmit means that you're going to send it. And publicly doing it in the square is different than transmitting. What you have in on display is on display. But when you transmit it, you transmit it to a network that will be with the child for the rest of their lives. And there are instances where young people have committed suicide as a result of their parents using social media to bully them.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I could give you examples. There was a young girl, 10-year-old girl, that was her father cut her hair off and she actually jumped from the building. I'll send you guys this information. And it is unfortunate that parents will go to the extreme and believe that this is the best way to discipline. You can discipline your children however you want in your home. And you can discipline your kids with social media bullying, but you need to understand that there are consequences when you do that to your child. They have to go to school the next day, and they have to deal with their friends. Children need protection. And all this bill does, whether it needs more work to clarify the language or not, this bill's intent is to make sure that children are protected from lifelong challenges that they may have from parents using social media to try to discipline them.
Mm-hmm. So this is preparing the world for the child rather than the child for the world, right? So I can't even think about what or why a parent would, you know, go on to Twitter to like rant about their kid or something like that. I don't see that happening very much, except perhaps facetiously, or my kid did this, or usually it's the opposite. It's usually it's bragging and so forth, right? Or celebrating an achievement. So it just seems to me this is like a problem or a solution in search of a problem, and particularly for the state to intercede. I mean, it's this you can do whatever you want, except here we are watching your administration of your family and your relationship with your kid. And it starts in social media, as you say, although I think the language in here is very unclear. But then if it's good enough for social media and the issue is to avoid public shame that could hurt the self-esteem of the child, then why limit it to social media if that's the rationale for the legislation in the first place? Why not if you see somebody yelling at their kid at a basketball game? How could you miss that shot, pass the ball, whatever, and the kid holds his head down and he feels shame or he's embarrassed by his father? Then that's time to call the police, get this guy out of here. That's parental bullying.
I'm glad you made the distinction, because the difference in those discipline ways is the parent yelling at their child at the game, it goes away. It will not be on social media, not if someone records it. If someone records it, then they could post it later. That's a different thing. But when a parent deliberately takes discipline actions and sit their kids down and publicly post their discipline for the world to see, it will last forever. There are cases where parents have actually made their kids hold signs saying that, "I will never do drugs again." And they had to pull the sign, stand outside, and let people see this. Guess what?
Yeah, I've seen
this. This is bad.
Even if you don't agree with that, to criminalize that, what is the problem with shame? Shame is how you learn that you did something wrong. Shame is what forms your conscience. Say, this is a shameful thing. I don't want to embarrass myself or my family. And so I know that if I do this or if I do that, I behave this way or that way, that will bring shame onto me and my family, and I want to avoid that. I mean, this idea that everybody's so fragile, they need their self-esteem protected at any time for every reason, no matter what they do, says who? The state?
No, it's not even about the self-esteem only. It's about the future of that child. Let's say a child decides that they want to go and get a scholarship to go to a college. The colleges now, they use social media and they search the profile of students. When they Google this child, or go on social media and find that this child had an incident with drugs, they can actually deny, or they may deny a child an opportunity for a scholarship or entry into their school. We know social media employers now use social media and they check the internet before they hire people.
Yeah.
Now you see this child and this person, now they may not hire these people. Parents just can't whimsically do things to their children because there are long-term impacts.
Who says making your child hold a "I will not do drugs" sign, just to use that example, and posting it or just doing it in the neighborhood, who says that's whimsical? That seems to me exactly that's intended to shame, intended to call out the bad behavior. I mean, it seems to me that the whole premise of this is just it seems upside down to me, LaShawn. On the one hand, the actual problem in Chicago and Illinois and generally is the lack of parents and the lack of parental involvement. And here you want to use extreme cases, which are always the bad always a bad predicate to make law, that where parents are involved with disciplining their kids because you think it will extend the shame or the punishment beyond the acceptable term of the shame or punishment. I mean, how is the state in the best position to judge that?
Oh, we have what you call child abuse laws. I'm a teacher by profession, and I've been in the classroom. Children could be very, very cruel. Mm-hmm. I am of the
so put them in prison.
Yeah. You know, I'm of the awareness that. We have to be, we can't coddle kids too much. But this, what I'm saying is we cannot put them in a situation where we drive them to suicide, where children, that's the problem. Parents could do whatever they want behind closed doors, but how many times, I just don't agree that it's the perfect way to publicly discipline your child. It's abuse, and studies have shown it. This is not just LaShawn saying it. Studies have shown that when you publicly shame a child, you humiliate that child, and it's inappropriate.
Uh-huh. And so if we're trying to prevent teen suicide here, the lockdown politicians, when are they prosecuted? as the for negligent homicide, for manslaughter, for all the kids that develop mental illness and acute mental illness. The studies. We got lots of studies about that. All the kids suffering from mental illness because of being locked out of their school and locked down and isolated socially. When do all the lockdown of politicians, starting with your governor there, J.B. Pritzker, when do they get charged with crimes?
Well, I don't
anything to prevent case. Anything to prevent any shame or loneliness or, you know, mental distress, anything and everything. And somebody who instigates it, however far the nexus is from actual culpability, that they should be criminally prosecuted. That's essentially the position here. Why doesn't it go for lockdowns?
Well, this would not put a parent in jail. This simply says that a parent, if they and it's about deterring the behavior and the discipline of children. Children need advocates. They need people to protect them.
They also need to be disciplined, and they crave discipline.
That's right. Let me tell you, the best students that I had was the students that I disciplined. My daughter loves me when I discipline her more and more. She loves it, and she likes getting better.
Has she ever been embarrassed by you?
You know, she was embarrassed by me once. And it was, I would say that I would never do it again.
Well,
unnecessary. I didn't have to embarrass her. It was like a power struggle.
You're lucky your law wasn't enforced. Otherwise, we'd be talking about LaShawn Ford, the child abuser who embarrassed his daughter.
No, because if my law, if passed and signed by the governor, says that you cannot transmit a discipline of a, not that you can't publicly discipline. I remember taking my nephews to Florida, and I was in the bathroom giving him the business and yelling at him in Florida at Disney World because he was just not behaving right. And do you know, someone came up to me and told me that they were going to call the police on me, but I took them to the bathroom. They're going to call the police on me because I'm in the bathroom because my nephew was out of control, and I'm trying to pull him in control. We're at Disney World. Relax. You know, but I actually was approached saying, you cannot discipline your child. Call the police.
Right. That's part of the problems with the culture, and you're exacerbating that problem with this legislation.
Now, we have to make sure, Dan and Amy, that we make a distinction between disciplining and publicly, social media, cyberbullying. That's the difference. Cyberbullying lasts for life. Children will do well with discipline. That's what you do to children. You discipline them. But when you put it on social media where their friends could actually see what happened in their household, children are mean, and now they have to walk in that classroom. There was cases that I will send you guys where a father actually cut his son's hair like X's, and it was horrible, and made him go to school. He posted it on social media. Everyone saw it. That's just not right. We have to protect the children.
The language commits parental bullying when he or she knowingly and with the intent to discipline.
That's right. And you know what? I think
the intent to discipline.
You and Amy did a good job at bringing this to our attention. And you're right. This should be cleaned up and it should be made better.
All right.
And that makes sense. And that's what making public policy is about, communicating and making sure that we get it right. This bill came from a constituent. I gave the power to her to work this, and she's doing a great job at working it. And now it's on full display for us to make it better. And she's making sure that she meets with other stakeholders. And we're going to make it better. We're going to amend it so that it's passed in a proper form. But the intent is simply to make sure that we prevent social media bullying.
He is State Representative LaShawn Ford. He's a Democrat from the west side of Chicago. LaShawn, we do appreciate you coming on and hashing this out with us. Always a stand-up guy, so appreciate that. And we appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
All right. We got a text message that says, when I was a kid, I stole a candy bar. My dad made me wear a sign around my neck that said liar, and I never stole again.
Well, we'll check with LaShawn on the statute of limitations. Maybe we can still have your dad arrested.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's not too late.
Yeah. All right. No, that wasn't my story. That was somebody who texted.
I know. That person's. But I like LaShawn, but I mean, good grief. That's a bit of a stretch.
Let parents parent. All right. Coming up. Thank you so much for making this part of your morning. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Justin Kosick, our technical producer, and Quinn McCarthy, our executive producer, and Josh and Eric. And the whole family's here today. And Mike Scott, so glad you're back in the studio so I can see your beautiful face.
Well, thanks.
It makes me happy.
I didn't know I was beautiful.
We need the Oscar music to get her off the stage.
Yes, we do. Get the hook. Take her off. Outside, clear skies. And today, sunny and chilly with a high of 37. WIND, Chicago News Time 9.
There's a rally on Wall Street and inflation hits an 18-month low. I'm Chris Foster, Fox News.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.